You doing?
I'm doing great. How are you, Jason?
Good, good. So I'm excited to raise this last $200, but I can't do it on my own here.
No, we need some help. We need somebody to call right now at 845-482-4141. They could send a letter, but that would come too late. We need a call, or we need somebody to go online at wjffradio.org.
wjffradio.org, wjffradio.org, or give us a call at 845-482-4141. Folks, I just talked to some people over there at the wholesale studio, and they're excited to finish raising this challenge. And again, this challenge is in honor of John and Claire and Ramble Tamble. We need to make this challenge, and we have just an hour left to raise this $200. And I've got a new show to do now. and then we've got the daily. So there's not a whole lot more time for me to ask. So once we get into the news, we're just going to have to trust that you're going to make that donation you've been meaning to make now to help us make this $200.
20 years of Ramble Tamble. Been going for 20 great years.
845-482-4141, 845-482-4141. Go to WJFFradio.org and make your donation that way as well. Thane and I will be back before long. The local edition is coming up next.
Catholic Charities Prevention Services has resources and supplies for youth, parents, and other community members that can help keep children and families safe. Medication trackers, lock bags, lock caps, medication destruction packets, and more. Learn how to be educated, involved, and active participants in the fight against drug and alcohol use. More information at cccsos.org or 845-794-8080. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster. You're listening to Radio Catskill, WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Holmesdale, Pennsylvania, this is a local edition. I'm your host, Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with us this evening. Coming up, we have a special exclusive report here on National Pet Day. And check in with the Sullivan County ASPCA. But first up, we've got our regular weekly check-in with the Times Union. Earlier today, I spoke with the Times Union Hudson Valley Bureau editor, Philip Pantuso. And we started the conversation talking about one of the Republican candidates that are currently running for New York's 18th district. This is a closely watched race, but exclusive reporting, breaking news from the Times Union shows that apparently this candidate, Allison Esposito, apparently did not pay her campaign staff for the last quarter of last year. Here's Philip Pantuso.
Yeah, this was the scoop that we published yesterday morning. Allison Esposito, who was former Republican candidate for lieutenant governor, Lee Zeldin's running mate, now the current Republican candidate for New York's 18th congressional district, listed no expenses or expenditures for payroll or for staff in her Federal Election Commission filings for the last quarter of last year, which is October through December. That includes essentially the first 3 months of when she announced her campaign, which was on October 10th. Pretty surprising, particularly since her campaign filings, which are, you know, and all campaigns are required, or all candidates, sorry, must report to the Federal Election Commission how they spend campaign funds. Her expenditures were $52,000 and include, airline and Amtrak tickets, campaign attire, other kind of minor expenses, but nothing for payroll and nothing for any kind of healthcare subsidy or any other sort of staff payments, even though she has a campaign manager and has since she launched her campaign. And she also currently has a communications director. By comparison, her opponent in that race, current Representative Pat Ryan, listed more than $288,000 in disbursements, so nearly six times as much as Esposito. And nearly half of that went toward payroll, payroll taxes, fees, and healthcare stipends.
What are the implications of this? I mean, up front, it might sound odd, but is there necessarily anything wrong with that?
Well, it's not illegal for the campaign to rely on volunteers if that's what's happening here. And, of course, a lot of campaigns do rely on volunteers at various levels, like, you know, ground teams or door knockers, things like that. But experts told us that it's far less common for high-ranking staff to not be paid, including, you know, the campaign manager and communications director. You know, the implications are, it sort of depends what the error is here. So if she is paying them and she didn't report that in her filings, that would be a campaign finance violation that would need to be amended. Side note, we tried several times to talk to her and to her staff. All of our inquiries went unresponded to. The one time she did pick up the phone when our reporter called, she told him to send her another email and then hung up on him and did not reply to the email that we sent in response to that. If these folks are just working as volunteers, then, you know, there's no violation there. It just would be pretty unusual. And I think it says something about, I guess, the relative size of the campaigns. If you have one candidate that's spending, you know, nearly $140,000 every quarter on staff and another spending zero in what is supposed to be a pretty competitive race that may be key to the Republican Party's hopes of maintaining control of Congress in 2024.
Yeah, this is a district, one of those New York upstate districts that really impacted the makeup of the House 2 years ago, and the country has kind of been keeping half an eye on since then. Is there any word from Esposito's opponents, whether that's Loveland Gwynn, who's running to get the GOP nomination for the 18th district, or the person she hopes to run against in the 18th district, current Congressman Pat Ryan? Response from either of those campaigns?
Pat Ryan, or supporters of Pat Ryan anyway. I'm not sure if he has said anything about this yet, but the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which, you know, funds incumbent Democrat races and challengers across the country, They have said that this is highly suspicious. Haven't heard anything from her opponent in the GOP yet, but, you know, certainly something we'll be monitoring, and I'll be looking forward to her next FEC filings to see if there is payroll on those.
I'll be looking forward to what you find when you do that, and we'll definitely be talking about that right here. Now on to Dutchess County. You have a story that involves county public transit bus routes in Poughkeepsie?
Yeah, so Dutchess County this year, in an attempt to save a little bit of money, and this was ordered by County Executive William F.X. O'Neill, is trimming back bus service on a couple of lines. The main affected line is the M line that runs through the city of Poughkeepsie. And they are removing one stop and reducing the service. That line is primarily used by two groups of people. One is commuters to Poughkeepsie schools, stops at a lot of the schools in town. And then another are seniors who live at Maplewood Apartments, which is a senior residence in downtown Poughkeepsie. So the stop that's being removed is a stop that is inside, or essentially right outside, the apartment complex, the senior residential apartment complex, which is really drawing the ire of the residents who live there and their representatives in the county legislature, who, it should be noted, had to pass this because it was part of a budget proposal, but they were not, they now say that they didn't have really the full information about what the effects of these changes would be. And so that they're now trying to sort of claw back some of the proposed changes to public transit there. The seniors are saying that removing this bus stop will force them to walk to the next nearest bus stop, which is a half a mile away, and they have to cross the westbound Route 55 arterial through that runs through the middle of the city. And as anybody who's been at Poughkeepsie knows, that's a very sort of high-speed, dangerous road. There have been many crashes there. It's designated by the county as a high crash corridor. So that's certainly troubling to the seniors in particular. Our reporter who worked on the story, Dean Kapitsky, he spoke with a couple of them. Even the ones who are able to make it to that bus stop, now, you know, the schedule is tailored to students. It's only going to run five times a day, between like 6:30 and 8:30 a.m., and then again at 3:05 p.m. and 4:12 p.m. And so if you need the bus at any other time, including like one of the women that Dean spoke to, it's not going to be there. Like this one woman says she's now going to have to start taking taxis, and that's going to like quadruple what she spends on transportation every month. So it does seem like the county is listening to some of the feedback, both from affected locals and from the Poughkeepsie Common Council, which is trying to get these changes reversed. An initial version of the changes also called for reducing a connection between Tivoli, Bard College, and Rhinebeck. That was scrapped after robust pushback. And the county kind of keeps pushing back the date at which these changes will be implemented. The most recent target was June 1. They now say that's no longer feasible and that there is not yet a planned date for the changes to take effect. So all of this is certainly coming under more consideration than apparently it had when it was initially proposed.
Wow. Yeah. And now on to Orange County. You've got a story, a breaking story about the Orange County partnership. Could you start off just give us a thumbnail of what the partnership is? Is this different than the Orange IDA, right?
Yeah. It is similar to the IDA in that right. it supports economic development in Orange County. It's a nonprofit that was incorporated in 1985, and there's been a sort of decade long battle about whether it is what's called a local authority, which IDAs are, and other local agencies are. And if you are designated as a local authority, that means that you are subject to the public authorities law in New York State, which comes with all of these requirements with regards to transparency, including holding open meetings, publicizing your budget, complying with freedom of information law requests, et cetera. The Orange County Partnership has said it is not a local authority. It has said that it is a private nonprofit corporation and that it needs to essentially stay that way in order to not reveal too much about the bids it gets and its deliberations, which they say could have anti-competitive effects were those revealed. The authority's budget office, which is the state agency that oversees local authorities, has said pretty consistently since 2011 that the Orange County Partnership is a local authority. This has gone to the courts, and just yesterday, I think it was, the State Appeals Court said that it is indeed a local authority, which makes it subject to the same compliance and disclosure requirements of all other public agencies.
Wow. Is there any response from the Orange County Partnership?
Yeah, they disagree. The Orange County Partnership CEO and President Maureen Hallahan told Lana Bellamy that they are going to pursue available remedies to challenge this recent decision. The only available remedy they have left would be to take it up to the state's highest court, which is the Court of Appeals. So, you know, unclear at this point if they're going to do that, or certainly when, but all indications are that may well happen.
Is this a unique case, or is there any indication that this ruling will have an impact on similar organizations, for instance, the Sullivan County Partnership for Economic Development?
Not a unique case at all. And in fact, I think there was another ruling from the State Appellate Division's third department, just a little bit further upstate, just back in December, over this exact same question with regards to the Saratoga Economic Development Corporation, which is essentially the same thing, like a local nonprofit that supports economic development. You know, the way these things work is really kind of murky. You know, here in Ulster County, the head of, or formerly anyway, the head of the Ulster County Economic Development Corporation and the Ulster County IDA were the same person. So the ruling in December also ruled that the Saratoga Economic Development Corporation needed to comply with the Public Authorities Act. And, you know, it seems like that was precedent for the ruling regarding the Orange County Partnership this week. So clearly there is a pattern here.
Okay. And, you know, finally, before we go, real quick, we did touch on this earlier in the week, that Sullivan County Head Start, after its sudden closure at the start of February, finally this week, just 2 days ago, reopened. Can you just tell us a little bit about that quick and explain to me why this might not be the permanent fix?
Yeah. So basically, you know, it was able to resume services on Tuesday, as you mentioned, at three facilities in the county. It's temporary because when it closed a couple of months ago, the nonprofit that was administering the Head Start program relinquished its grant, which allowed the federal office of Head Start to transition the operations to another service provider. They were basically able to just get everything back up and running, but they're still operating on the 12 months of funding that the former nonprofit relinquished. So they need to apply for further funding, and that transition, I guess, is only meant to be temporary.
Okay, and that jibes what we were hearing from county officials when they were in the midst of scrambling to get Head Start restarted. In your reporting, any reaction from either the workers or the parents that are involved with Head Start in Sullivan County?
Yeah, I mean, many of the workers are hoping to be able to get their jobs back, and it does seem like at least some of them will, although, again, that's going to be, for now anyway, on a short-term temporary basis. We talked to several of the families who were affected by the closure initially. You know, a lot of them are going to go back, but several have already moved on. You know, we talked to one Youngsville resident who enrolled her three-year-old daughter at a healthy kids school in Liberty. She's going to keep her there now, because she's already bedded in and she's been there for a couple of months. So it does seem like not everybody who was initially affected by this is going to be able to go back.
And thanks to Philip Pantuso, managing editor of the Times Union, for speaking to us earlier today. And all the stories that we talked about are up now at TimesUnion.com. This is the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole, and I want to thank you so much for being here with us. We have another story coming right up.
You're listening to the Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Hi, it's Michelle Martin. From the station you're listening to right now to our headquarters in D.C., NPR is a network. And that includes listeners like you. Please do your part and give today.
This station relies on the support of listeners like you. Every donation we receive gets us that much closer to our fund drive goal. Go to WJFFradio.org to make your donation now.
Hey, it's Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Aisha Roscoe.
One of the things you can count on from NPR and this station, we've got your back when it comes to reporting the news, bringing you facts you can count on. You can help by donating a vehicle you no longer need.
That car could be worth hundreds of dollars in support or more as a donation.
Think about it.
We accept any vehicle, running or not, including cars, trucks, boats, RVs, motorcycles, and more. Donate at WJFFradio.org.
We move anywhere from 55 to...
Welcome back to the Local Edition. I'm your host, Jason Dole. And up next now, we have a special report about a local animal shelter.
We move anywhere from 55 to 75 pets a month get adopted here. Cats, kittens, dogs, and puppies. But, you know, as soon as we have room, there's more to come in. So it's just a revolving door.
This is John Atthut. He was a veterinary nurse for 33 years. Since last May, he has become the current director of Sullivan County SPCA Animal Shelter.
We're over 250 local animals for the past year. Plus, we take in animals from down south, Kentucky, that are in kill shelters, and they're rescued from them, and then the group brings them up to us. And so, you know, every day it's walking, playing with the dogs, the cats, socializing them, feeding them, cleaning up after them, and dealing with people coming in, surrendering their animals. You know, that seems to be a daily occurrence these days.
The shelter has more than 250 animals, but there are only 5 people on the team.
We have we have 2 full-time people, 3 part-time people, and then volunteers. But yeah, it's a lot of work. And myself, I work 6-7 days a week sometimes. You know, I'm here at 7 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes I only leave till 5 o'clock at night. And then I do, like, help with the fundraising stuff. And, you know, it was the Easter Bunny last weekend. For Christmas, I'm the Santa Claus, and we take pictures and all. So, yeah, it's busy.
John is not the only one who is experiencing this situation. Low adoption and low staff are 2 main problems of animal shelters in New York State after the pandemic.
We're just not seeing the volume of adopters that we need in order to adopt the volume of animals that we're seeing come into the shelters.
This is Aurora Velasquez. She is the regional manager of the Eastern Region at Best Friends Animal Society.
Lots of folks think that maybe there's a huge influx of animals coming into the shelters, but really the intake is about the same as pre-pandemic level, so it's not a huge increase, but the adopters, for whatever reason, just aren't there. And so animals are staying longer, shelters are filling up, and it's becoming really tough to sort of stay on top of that. And there have just been some studies put out by different organizations that younger generations, you know, your millennials, your Gen Zs, have been buying more dogs from breeders and pet stores and things like that. So in the animal welfare, animal shelter rescue space, we have to figure out how to get the message out to them in a new and sort of refreshed way that really resonates.
And the animal shelters have not become as accessible as it was before the pandemic.
The pandemic really changed how shelters operated. Hours changed, staffing levels changed, and some shelters have had a little bit of a difficult time sort of getting their operations back to a place of where they were pre-pandemic, where they were, you know, super accessible to the public, convenient hours, easy processes. And so, you know, for some adopters, it's just harder to adopt at shelters.
So what causes the staff shortage in animal shelters?
There's no plainer way to say it than animal work is hard work. It's often very physical. You know, I always like to joke, if you work in an animal shelter or you, you know, volunteer with a rescue, you don't need a gym membership because you're constantly moving. So you're in the best shape of your life.
And the job is also emotionally challenging. John shares the story he knows about how the animals came to the shelter.
We get the people moved out next door and left the dog in the house. They heard it barking. You know, there was no water, food. They don't know what kind of dog it is. So we take an educated guess, you know, the best we can. But we still don't know the history of the dog. There is a lot of sadness in the shelter to go along with the happiness when you find homes for them. And while I've been doing it a long time, you know, since being in the vet field, so I guess I have a little better coping skills than the new people. But yeah, I mean, I cry still, and you know, new people cry more than I cry, but you know, it happens. Look, I'm getting teary-eyed now just talking about it. It's, you know, it's what happens.
But this physically and emotionally demanding work doesn't pay well. According to U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, animal care and service workers' median pay is $14 per hour.
When you could get a job elsewhere that's a little bit easier on you as a human and make comparable wages, you know, it's kind of a hard sell. It can be tricky to keep people long-term because it is demanding in so many ways. I think partially that a lot of organizations are nonprofit, and so it's really reliant on donations. And when everybody's struggling financially, those donations can be hard to come by. Some organizations are municipal and funded through city government, county government, and, you know, those kinds of entities have so many priorities and so many places to allocate budget. Often we see animal organizations sort of at the bottom, unfortunately.
The reality is harsh. But people are persistently striving to improve the situation. Recently, about $3.8 million has been granted to 10 animal care groups in New York State. The funding will support construction, renovation, and expansion projects that will enhance animal care, health, and adoptions. In communities, animal shelters are helping each other to relieve the heavy burden of excessive homeless animals.
So we work with an organization in sort of the western part of the state, like Erie County. They're called 10 Lives Club. They're a cat-only shelter. So they have their main shelter, but then they have these sort of little pop-ups all over their area. And what they do is they reach out to other organizations who are maybe struggling. They have more cats than they can find homes for, and they'll transfer them to their organization to find them homes. So we're working with them now to set up a regular transfer of cats from 7 or 8 different organizations around the upstate New York region to just sort of keep that flow of cats going, because they have the adopters there. They don't have the cats. So going to other areas that have the cats, but not the adopters, and just sort of moving them over.
As an NGO focused on homeless animals and adoption, Best Friend Animal Society is trying to use AI and machine learning to analyze data and identify possible solutions for different communities.
What's happening over here is going to be different than what's happening over here. So it's not going to be a one size fits all, here's the solution. You know, it's really about what's happening in this particular community, this particular region, informed by the data. And so that'll be a really exciting thing, sort of using the AI and machine learning as it looks through this data and learns about what solutions exist.
As a local resident in Sullivan County, what can we do to help animal shelters?
Adoption is huge. It's wonderful, but maybe all you can do is 2 hours a week walking dogs or playing with cats. And that is tremendous. As we see animals staying longer in shelters, that ability to get out and go for a walk and burn off some energy is what's going to keep them emotionally sound and sort of stable until their family walks through the shelter doors. If you don't have time to contribute your time as a volunteer, donate. Every little bit helps. You know, donations don't have to be hundreds or thousands of dollars. $25, $50 can buy some toys or some food. That's really going to make a difference to those animals. So there is a way to help that everybody can access. And these are animals that are in our community already. And so, like, they're our animals too. So I always encourage folks to think about them as that, and just, you know, whatever little thing you can do, do that. And collectively, we can all make a difference.
In Liberty, I'm Laying Town for Radio Catskill.
Thank you so much, Laying, for that report. And thank you, listener, for listening to Local Edition. And thank you to Vicky from Damascus, Mary from Narrowsburg, and Susan from Lenox Manor, who joined listeners Scott, Edwin, Cynthia, Melissa, Edward, David, and Mark, who helped us blow past the $700 challenge. Thane, we raised $800 towards the $700 challenge.
Whoa, we did too much.
All right. Thanks to everyone. Please keep calling 845-482-4141. Call